We're talking with Dr. Diana Pasulka about her new book, American Cosmic, the subtitle, UFOs, Religion, and Technology. And if that sounds like maybe she's throwing a pretty wide net, I think that's probably what this subject needs. You know, you got people in ufology who are comfortable with studying what has been called the nuts and bolts aspects of it, flying saucers, technology, craft from other worlds, looking for bits and pieces of those, but they get pretty uncomfortable when it gets into what people would call the woo-woo factors, the aspects of the UFOs topic that go far beyond ETs and flying craft. Exactly. That's the conclusion that was reached by our government a while back. You know, there was this program, ATIP, that we all know about now, the one that was headed up by Lou Elizondo for several years, that was looking at radar cases and encounters between unknown craft and our U.S. military, and looking at the technology that was employed, whether we could duplicate that technology or figure it out. But somewhere along the line, around 2007, some very bright people figured out there's so much more to this subject, so much more to the bigger topic than technology, that it really requires a much broader kind of understanding of what some would label as woo-woo and religion. And you have to admit that what we've heard on this program over the years, these profound experiences that people have during their encounters, are very similar to religious epiphanies. They are life-changing. They are, for all intents and purposes, spiritual changes, burning bush type events. But instead of burning bushes, it's little gray aliens. We're going to get into that and ask Diana how she ended up in the secret archives of the Vatican right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Diana. At the beginning of your book, you mentioned Robert Bigelow appearing on 60 Minutes and saying aliens are real, and I don't care if you think I'm crazy. At the end of your book, you reference the revelations that came out in the December 2017 New York Times story about ATIP and all the developments that have been in the news since then. It's an amazing time and amazing timing for you. You started this project in 2012, had no idea that by the time you got finished and were ready to publish that the world, the whole world, would be talking about UFOs. Good timing.
Yes. Yes. Oh, thanks. It has nothing to do with me. The book itself is fascinating to me because I look at it, I almost feel that it wrote itself, and I was its pen. And so if, George, if it's possible, I'd like to go back to this idea of technology, because I think it's really important,
sure.
The, you know, woo-woo and technology connection, if that's okay, before we
sure.
talk about the Vatican.
Yes.
Okay. So there were several things that were happening in the 1940s that were very interesting, 1940s and 1950s, that seemingly had nothing to do with each other, but in one way, but have correlations nonetheless. And one was the creation of the space programs, the Russian space program and the United States space program. And when I went back, I had to do some research about that. And I started researching each. And what I found, there's a great book by George Young called The Russian Cosmos. And it's a history of some of the founders of rocket technology. And what I found was that, like Konstantin Tchaikovsky, had these beliefs that were absolutely woo-woo, okay? Yet, it was these beliefs that helped him construct these equations that later became the foundation for the Russian space program. And similarly, in our own space program, we have a similar history of people who would, you know, had what would only be described as out there woo-woo types beliefs and practices that created the our space program. Now, it's something we can't talk about. The Russians are much more open about it. We're really close. The United States is really close. So a lot of those archival studies were closed to me, even though at first they were seemingly open. They were like, sure, yeah, come in, take a look at it. Then I think they did some research and found that I had one article that had UFO in the title, and after that it was like, no. Okay, so, you know, I'm not going to go in and look at those sources. So there's that. another thing that was happening was that this philosopher, Martin Heidegger, who, by the way, today's philosophers are quite, he's a controversial figure, let's put it that way. But he had a very interesting idea of technology, and it was that he viewed it as, you know, it is as transformative as the Christian God was for Western civilization. Technology is going to bring on this new epic. And in fact, technology is not what we think it is. We don't use technology. We actually, we exist in a symbiotic relationship to it. So, so given those kinds of things, I brought that idea, both of those ideas, I brought them to bear on the two characters, Tyler and James, who represented two parts of the study. James represented kind of the looking at the physiological aspects of people who have interface with the phenomena, and Tyler looking at the physical aspects. Both, though, were reminded me of these early founders in that they did have these woo-woo beliefs, but they were they were geniuses. They're just geniuses. I just have to say it. So so this technological thing. There's a researcher, a philosopher at University of Connecticut, Susan Schneider. She's spoken to NASA, and basically what she had said, and she's got a great article out there. You can Google her name and come up with it. I can't remember the name of it, but if you type in Susan Schneider aliens, it'll come up. And basically she makes this case, which has been made before. When and if we come in contact with, you know, another life form, it's going to be their technology or they will be technology. Okay. And so, so this then brought me back to this conundrum faced in the ufology community, but not just the ufology community, you know, maybe Bigelow's camp or people who study the phenomena, you know, they're looking at the science of it, but they really need to start looking at the people who interface with it, who are the scientists, because these people are different. These are people who are, they have woo skills that they're not necessarily woo-woo. I think you mentioned a quote in the beginning of the program that at some point we'll learn that there is a scientific basis for these types of skills. But the U.S. military has already figured out that people that have these skills are useful. And so they don't necessarily, you know, I have many students who are veterans, some of whom have been recruited into, you know, and promoted because of these, what they call the sixth sense. They don't know what it is, but they know it works. So they're more strategic about it rather than like professors asking, well, we don't have evidence for it. Well, if it works, it works. And that's kind of the military's way of understanding it. If it works, we're going to use it. And if it's not real, it doesn't really matter. It's working. So, so the people, you know, like look at Tyler and James in the first part of my book, they're making inroads into the study of the phenomena. And it's not because they're particularly efficient at the physics of propulsion or something like that. It's because the ways in which they use their brains is different. And a lot of that has to do with woo-woo things like synchronicities. There were so many synchronicities and strange, meaningful coincidences, improbable types of things that happened that I had to actually give that some time in the book. So I did that as well. I spent some time talking about, you know, almost everybody who has this type of experience says, well, you know, and in fact, people who are religious, you know, synchronicity and meaningful coincidence is like the language of these kinds of encounters in all religions, and absolutely the case with respect to the ufological research.
And here we are, your book coming out precisely at this time. I don't know if it's coincidence or synchronicity or just a wild accident, but it's just about perfect. You know, I can tell you this, is that at least contractors who've been working for the military and intelligence outfits are aware of sort of the woo-woo DNA connection, how and they call it biomarkers, or they have used humans and animals as biosensors and have studied it. And I hope that we're going to be hearing more about that. You look at some events that happen to UFO people, contactees, abductees, and, you know, there are supernatural elements to it. I don't know what else you would call it. There are elements that are so far beyond just ETs, flying saucers, the equivalent of a burning bush or a spiritual epiphany, something like that, that you need a really big tent to look at this. You can't just look at nuts and bolts to understand it.
No, you can't. I mean, my perspective is that if it's data and if it recurs and it's a pattern, you have to pay attention to it, or that's not good research.
Let's talk about you end up in the Vatican. I mean, this is not something anybody can go in there and check books out like a library, right?
No, it's not. It's a year process to get in. So,
what did you want to find in there?
All right. So, this is funny because it segues from our idea. You know what we've been talking about, synchronicities. So this in the beginning was unrelated research to my UFO research, okay? So, kind of. I mean, so we do, so I was asked by a person I won't name, but who is a billionaire philanthropist interested in the levitation of Joseph of Cupertino and saints in the Catholic Church who've had these skills. Perhaps they had these biomarkers, I don't know. But these were very specific types of people that they were interested in. They asked me to go to the Vatican Secret Archive, which is the private archive of the Pope, and to look into these manuscripts, which are old manuscripts from basically the 1700s. The saints existed in the 1600s, but it took a while to write up their records. And their records, literally, if you were to stack them on top of each other, are about 2 feet tall, dense. Latin, 17th century Italian, it's just, you know, a very difficult undertaking. And so at this point, I had a team of people who studied the phenomena. You know, Jacques was helping me. I had James, I had Tyler. So I had a team of people who were interested in aerial phenomena and the people who encountered aerial phenomena. And so I realized that this could possibly be a rich resource for aerial phenomena in the historical record. And why don't we take a look at that? So you have to have special credentials to get into the archive. Like you said, no, you just can't get in. You have to be, you have to have a PhD in religion or theology, and you have to have a record of research, and you have to have a university affiliation, all of which I had, so I could get in. I decided that I wanted Tyler to come with me because Tyler was an expert at aerial phenomena, and I thought that, you know, he doesn't know anything about Catholic history, but I was going to, I actually tested him by translating some of the sources of Francis of Assisi, who encountered a seraph, which is an angel, that looked pretty suspect to me now that I knew the UFO literature. And I said, I translated the original source for him so he could read it. And he read it and he said, oh yeah, yeah, this is a, you know, this is a, when these things come into the atmosphere, this is what it looks like. This is the light associated with it. And so I said, this would be a great person to take. So I talked to the funding people and I said, this person needs to go with me. And so, and for this reason. And, you know, you can't, you know, you've got very conservative people in the Catholic Church. They don't want to talk about UFOs. They've got enough problems. They've got some PR problems already. So, you know, so I don't say, we're going to go check out historical sources of UFOs and perhaps, you know, people who were, you know, had the markers to identify them and, you know, be contacted and blah, blah, blah. And no, that's not going to cut it with them. So I had to, you know, massage the language and say, this is what we're doing. It's, we're looking at cases of aerial phenomena within history that will apply to Joseph of Cupertino. So, so I wanted to get Tyler into the archive, but I didn't know if I could. So we did everything we could. So he already had a lot of credentials but related to the space industry. So he was a space shuttle guy. So he'd been working on the space shuttle program pretty much his whole life. Had multiple affiliations with the space agencies. And so I thought, okay, it's going to look pretty weird, me, a Catholic historian, going in with a space person. So let's get, he also is an entrepreneur, so he used a lot of his, the ideas that he culled from the space research to create these amazing biotechnology companies. And so he was he's independently wealthy. And so I thought, well, he does do, you know, maybe we can use some of the people he knows who are well-known people and establishments and universities, and we can get him letters of recommendation to get him in. So we did that. So we got a lot of that. And so on the way to the Vatican, you know, it's a long plane flight ride. He went before I did. So he got there before me, and he got to the archive and tried to get into the Vatican. They wouldn't let him in. And so I'm texting him on the airplane, and he's like, what do I do? And I say, well, try this or try that. So it took about 2 or 3 hours. And, you know, this is kind of like, there are three people you have to go through in order to get finally into the archive. And the first person is not even letting him in. And so he finally says, can I just show them who I am? And I'm like, what is he talking about? Who he is? You know, he's not necessarily famous. In fact, he's invisible. However, he thinks that he can show them something and get in. And I said, well, is it going to get us in trouble or anything? And he goes, no. And I said, okay, go ahead. So he showed him a card, which was, a card of an affiliation. And as he showed the card, he dropped something, went to pick it up, and looked up at the computer and saw his face on the computer. And so apparently, because the Vatican is an ally of the U.S., he was given full access. And in fact, he was given greater access than me. So by the time I got there, Tyler had not only did he have full access to everything we needed to see, including the manuscripts, he had also made a friend there, a really holy priest who befriended us and took us all through the Vatican, introduced us to some papal advisors of the past, that, you know, they're in retirement, but they were papal advisor, Father Gumpel. You can look them up on Wikipedia. And so we were, it was an incredible experience because of that. It would not have happened to me, but with Tyler, it happened. So
he must, he knew the secret handshake of something.
yeah, he did. And so we got in there. And we weren't just going there. So we went to the secret archive and we did look at these manuscripts. And one of the manuscripts we were supposed to look at was of a Spanish nun, Sister Maria of Agreda, who also levitated and she said she bilocated to a place in the United States. And if you go to New Mexico, you can actually hear about her, and there are churches in her name and that kind of thing. And she is she's up for canonization, although it may not happen. So let's put it this way. Her case has been pending for a long time. And so the person who had funded wanted to know, why didn't she get canonized and why did Joseph of Cupertino get canonized? So I was supposed to be there looking at that. So, and she was amazing. So she, in the 1600s, wrote about, her first book was basically not about bilocating to New Mexico to, to evangelize to the indigenous population there, which is what she said she did.
So she's like astral projection?
It's hard to say. She said that she traveled on the wings of angels. If you read her what she said.
And she ends up in New Mexico, which is the talk about a coincidence, given where your book starts, the journey you take blindfolded. We're talking with Diana Pasulka about American Cosmic. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about American Cosmic, UFOs, Religion, and Technology, Diana Pasulka's new book. And it's a fascinating look at the intersection of all three of those. A pretty interesting place to be. You know, you've got folks who will allege in a snarky sort of a way that those who pursue UFOs and aliens do so because they got a great big hole in their lives, that really aliens are some kind of a substitute for God or organized religion. And I don't know, maybe that's true for some people. I do know that a lot of folks who spend years chasing after this stuff, trying to figure it out, and then suddenly catch it, like a dog that chases cars and suddenly catches up to the tire. It hits you across the head like a baseball bat. It is a life-changing event. So in a sense, it is like a religious epiphany, and maybe UFOs, ufology is in effect a new religion. That's sort of where Diana started with her work, is trying to figure out, is this the birth of a new religion? When we come back, we're going to get into that. And then I want to return to discussing this journey she made out into the desert. She and her companions found some artifacts, and those artifacts are now being tested. And we've been hearing little bits and pieces and rumors about this testing program for several months now, and maybe she can shed some more light on it. We'll be right back. So, Diana, before the break, you've telling us about being in the Vatican archives, which I think I remember from your book is something like 53 square miles or 53 miles of archives down there, which is a heck of a lot. That's a pretty big library. You're going there to specifically look for information, documents about this nun who's up for sainthood, who had claimed that she had traveled on the wings of angels to New Mexico, of all places. At some point, as you're working on this book, the synchronicity of this has to hit you, but you're back in New Mexico.
Yes. So it was a very odd moment. So here I am working on this, what I believe is unrelated research, and it strikes me that I'm sometimes not too bright, but here it strikes me that she travels to New Mexico, and her first book is a book on cosmology and cosmography, where she basically, when she rides on the angel's wings, she's above the earth and she sees the spinning of the earth, you know, so this is in the 1600s. And so she's, you know, she's basically writing these things that are scientific, you know, strangely like psychic scientific journals, basically is what I'd call them. And so I realized, wow, I wonder if she traveled to the place that I was. So Tyler was there with me reading one of the old Kepler books and, or looking at it. He can't actually read it. So I mentioned this to him, and he looks at me, and he's just as shocked as I am. And he says to me, you know, he can't, of course, tell me because I was blindfolded, but I could tell by the look on his face that it was around that area. And so I thought, well, that's very strange and coincidental. It occurred to me then that, in fact, by that time, George, the book was finished. So I'd finished the book. And so I hadn't yet, well, I think I did. I think I sent it into my editor. And I thought that this was my next research project, was this looking at the saints thing. And then I realized that it had everything to do with the book. So I quickly wrote her back and I said, look, here's a really cool picture of, you know, the space archive. You know, I took some cool pictures for her. And I said, by the way, I think I have a last chapter. And she said, that's okay, go ahead. So this became my last chapter. And that's how the book kind of wrote itself, because I had to include that. And I had to include all that information in there because it provided a historical view of this type of phenomena that need, you know, and that she was in New Mexico was just too strange for me. I mean, you know, whether or not she really was in New Mexico didn't really matter. That she alleged she was in New Mexico in the 1600s, and, you know, she described the everything, the plants and the people and what they were wearing and everything like that. And that was a really weird moment for me. A synchronicity, whatever you want to call it. It was weird.
You know, you've been down this road, traveling down this road since 2012, immersing yourself in it, in all its weirdness and glory. And I can imagine maybe there is a point or multiple points, there was for me, where you are confronted with something. You know, it's fun to pursue it as an academic topic, and for me, a journalistic topic, a story that I'm chasing. and you're confronted with something somewhere along the way where it hits you that, oh my gosh, this is real. Whatever it is, we're not quite sure, but that it's real. And it's a profound moment and a troubling moment.
Yes, it is. So, and it happens in stages. And I think everyone remembers when they first think, oh my goodness. But I must at this point, though, distinguish my book and how I write my book and my press and distance them from my own personal perspectives on whether it's real. Because, you know, what I say Oxford isn't responsible for me saying, yes, I believe or I don't believe. I wrote the book from the perspective of an academic. In my personal life, though, I've had several of those moments. And in terms of looking at this as a religion, I would say this is that it's not just a new religion. It's a new form of religion. So, you know, your old forms of religion, you know, religions change. So prior to the big traditional religions that we see, you have pantheism or you have animism, right? And those are different forms of religion. So now, you know, with the rise of writing, you have these religions that are founded by people, like usually, you know, a charismatic figure like the Buddha or Muhammad or Jesus or something like that. What we have now is, you know, you had some UFO religions that were founded by people, you know, however, that's a minority, because right now what you have is you've got a movement all over the globe. Some call it the C5 movement, or, you know, the contact movement. And it's a diffuse movement. There are no head of, you know, it's not a hierarchy type of religion. If there are, you know, people are experiencing these things all over the place. So it's democratic. It's like a democratic type of religion. And when one person comes along and says, I have the truth, you know, I am the person who's been contacted, you know, like,
Oh, there's a few of those.
Yeah, I know. But you know what? Those are of like the 60s and 70s and 80s. That's not what's happening now. What's happening now is what I see to be something that is supercharged by our digital environment, where people, you know, we have networks of these movements where people talk to each other. They see anomalous phenomena. They start Facebook groups of that, and they talk to each other. And none of them are saying, I'm the boss of this new religion, right? In fact, if there's a sacred text in this religion, I would have to say it would have to be 2001, A Space Odyssey, because strangely enough, I never really enjoyed this movie when I first saw it. And I saw it again, and then I had to see it again. And then the more I saw it, the more I realized what the heck was going on and how brilliant. I mean, I know Kubrick is brilliant. I know this. However, his movies aren't necessarily enjoyable to watch, because a lot of them have fairly profound, deep messages that you don't quite understand even maybe a year later. So, you know, there's a great website called Collated Learning by Robert Ayer. And what he does is he analyzes movies, and he does an amazing analysis of the monolith in The Space Odyssey.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
His idea is that the monolith is the screen, is the screen culture. And when I watched that and looked at it, I thought to myself, wow, this is exactly what Heidegger would say. This is exactly what, say, David Bowie, who's brilliant and was maybe had not read Heidegger, but basically said the same thing in an interview in the 1980s. You know, the yeah. Internet is an alien life form. And I looked at my cell phone, my iPhone, and I thought, there it is, the monolith. And
well, we haven't really focused on the technology angle, but you make the point a couple of times in the book about how indispensable it is to, if this is a new religion, this is a pretty big part of it, because, you know, you have a UFO encounter or a UFO tale or a cover-up story, they get instantly transmitted around the world and retransmitted again and again. It makes you wonder if there had been TV cameras and the internet when Christ was roaming around, what the effect would have been on his early teachings.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So you do. So media plays a huge, huge, huge part in this. And, you know, you did mention Project Blue Book. And I do have, you know, something to say about this. And it's not that it's wrong that these are out there. It's wonderful, and I love it. The movie Arrival, I love that movie. So, and in fact, that movie, I thought, did a perfect treatment of woo-woo with science, right? So that was, you know, basically here you have this linguist going in with a scientist, a physicist, and they encounter something that appears to be woo-woo, but it's not, and when you know, it all comes out. But media is also a tool that can cause us to see things in certain ways, and that's where we have to be careful. So, you know, we're conditioned by what we see unconsciously, even though this is what I found out when I worked in The Conjuring. I actually worked on The Conjuring as applied methodology. So it wasn't like I was super interested in movies or anything. I was basically interested in how people learned religion through movies. And I was already, you know, I was already interested in that. So I was offered this job to do this, and I got to see up close. You know, that's the second top grossing movie about the supernatural in history. So a lot of people believe in that story. And so I saw the creation of this belief and how people believed. And I basically flesh out those techniques in the middle part of my book. And it's, you know, so we have to be careful when we consume media about UFOs. You know, are UFOs bad? You know, are they good? Or, you know, so let's our critical thinking skills, George, they don't even matter at this point, because there are different parts of our brain that consume the media, and it bypasses our rational capacity to say we believe or we don't believe.
Well, rational capacity, you're using air quotes around that, I assume, because it's in short supply a lot of times. I want to go back to talking about the journey out into the desert.
Sure.
Because I'm not sure everyone caught the significance of that. You go out there to a supposed crash site. You have to be blindfolded to get there. You spend the whole day sifting through debris that had been seemingly planted to discourage people just like you who might be looking for pieces of something that had been overlooked by the folks that went in to clear it up. You found it. You and your colleagues found some pieces. We've been hearing these stories for the last several months about metamaterials and strange metals and bits and pieces that have been stashed away in closets or in trunks or in the desert that have been located and are now being analyzed. Can you address any more about that? Would you expect that results of the analysis would be made public? Can you describe what the pieces look like?
Sure. Okay. First, that the pieces and what we found, I want to say that we find these in the first and second chapter. So my book opens with this journey and the finding of the pieces. And both James and I are not credulous. You know, we do wonder if these pieces are planted there for us to find. Okay, so we wonder that. The ways in which we found the pieces, though, suggested otherwise. I mean, you know, I said there were rattlesnakes out there. Like James, who's on fire to study this stuff, it's like his life's mission now. You know, he's digging under, like, you know, about 2 feet down and through, you know, these dangerous rock area, what I would not do, basically, because I'm afraid of these snakes. So he's digging down there, and it takes him quite a while, and he finally finds something. And, you know, so these were not, if they were planted, they were well planted. Now, why would somebody do that? I don't know. So we get these pieces, and most likely other people have these pieces as well, I would assume. Not a lot of people have these pieces. So we get these pieces, and there are, you know, we have a network of these scientists, some of whom don't talk about it, but study it. And so we do bring the pieces to those places where they're studied. I'm not going to say where they're studied. But these are people who can study these pieces. They are, you know, scientists with impeccable credentials. They're not, you know, you know, their publications are in the highest publications. So,
Is it metal? Is it chunks? Is it shredded pieces of metal that look like it's been a crash? Is it a ball bearing? Is it a cigarette lighter? What can you describe it in any
There are
more detail?
different parts. Yeah, there are different parts of the pieces. So there are different types of pieces. Apparently, now remember, I'm a non-scientist. So apparently from different parts of the craft. And part of it looks like, and if you go on the internet, you can find a lot of this kind of stuff, you know, it looks like aluminum foil, a little, you know, a little bit like really weird aluminum foil, but it's not. And then some of the other pieces look like, it's hard to describe them. They have a geometric pattern, and they don't look, they look somewhat intricate. And I've seen them under the microscope, and I've seen them on computer, in the computers that are able to identify their molecular structure and this kind of thing. And they confuse the people who study them. In fact, some of the people who study them don't know what they're studying. They just, they're part of the study, but they don't know what they, what these things are. And
well, it's good. They're analyzing it in the blind. That's good. Yeah.
They are. And they say, you know, to the people who are in charge of the study, James, let's say, and they say, what the heck is this? Some of the people who were included in impeccable credentials, like I said, said, okay, I want to take a picture of this and I want to put it on my wall, but I never want to talk to you guys again because they were so afraid. You know, they knew what they were looking at, but they were so afraid of the topic that they just didn't want to be involved. So that's the situation. So
do you expect that information to be made public? And I ask it in this context. We got about a minute left.
Sure.
You know, you can make the comparison. It would be the equivalent of finding a piece of material from somewhere else that wasn't made here, whether it's unobtainium, the metal or the element. If it's something that we can't make, that's profound evidence. I don't know if it's like finding the lost ark, but if you're starting a new religion of ufology, that would be a pretty profound moment, wouldn't it?
It would be. I don't think, though, George, that it's going to come out as the peer-reviewed paper for, you know, the definitive smoking gun of the UFO. I honestly think what's going to happen is these peer-reviewed papers are going to come out, but they're not going to talk about UFOs whatsoever, and that's how it's going to go. And, in fact, a lot of the inspiration and information, that's why I call Tyler the new type of Corso, you know, is that the inspirations for these biotechnologies that are actually being, you know, that we're using, you know, in our bodies right now that are helping us, are from these parts, you know, inspiration or whatever you want to call it. And that's my point in the book is that, wow, this is happening and it's happening and nobody knows it.
Well, hopefully they'll know more soon. Diana Pasulka, yeah. So great to talk to you. I really enjoyed the book, American Cosmic. I urge people to check it out and I hope you'll return and talk to us again.
Thanks so much, George. It was fun.
Thanks. Yes, it was. I'll be in touch. Thanks very much. We move on now. Next, coming up, Stan Michalak and Chris Rutkowski talking about when they appeared, the 1967 Falcon Lake encounter. We'll be right back. Johnny Nash into the break.